Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, what kind of leader will Joe Biden be? We'll spend this hour with Evan Osnos, who's just out with a biography that examines the ambitions and the losses that shape the way the president-elect relates to people and defines his responsibilities to constituents. We'll talk about how Biden's center-left pragmatism will play in this moment when the far right embraces Trumpism and the far left would prefer socialism. And we'll hear how he's preparing to take the reins from an administration that refuses to cooperate with the transition. Our conversation starts after a short break. Biden announced his first run for president as Ronald Reagan was finishing up his second term in the White House. 32 years later, Biden has finally won the office he dreamed of, and the job will come with challenges he could scarcely have imagined back in 1988. Americans are bitterly divided by partisan rancor, unrest over racial injustice, unsubstantiated allegations of massive election fraud, economic anxiety, and the proper response to COVID-19. How will our next president lead us through this? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. There is no question Biden knows how to persevere through hard times. He overcame a debilitating childhood stutter, raised his two sons as a single father when his first wife and daughter were killed in a car accident just before he was inaugurated into the Senate, survived a nearly fatal brain aneurysm, and watched his beloved son die of cancer. Now, just 3 days shy of his 78th birthday, Joe Biden is preparing to be president of the United States. So we wanted to look at the ways his past hardships, including a number of self-inflicted controversies, have shaped the man he is today. New Yorker staff writer Evan Osnos has carefully studied the facts of Biden's personal and political existence for his new book, Joe Biden, The Life, The Run, and What Matters Now. Evan, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be with you.
You open this book with a story that I have to say I didn't even remember, which is that Joe Biden very nearly died in 1988, and in fact may have been saved by the fact that he had to drop out of the Democratic primary race early on, and he had this long road back. What happened then?
Yeah, it's a story that I think a lot of us, frankly, overlook, and is quite dramatic. I mean, in the very beginning of 1988, Joe Biden woke up on the floor of a hotel room and couldn't figure out how he got there. I mean, he had had a catastrophic pair of aneurysms, a ballooning of two arteries in his brain, left him unable to walk at that moment. He was eventually able to get himself up out the door, and one of his aides helped get him to a hospital. And it was so severe that the surgeons called in a priest to deliver last rites even before Biden's wife, Jill, could get there. And they said to him at that point, you know, we're gonna take you into surgery, but you may never be able to speak again. And so I find it kind of interesting, just as an aside, that in that moment, somehow he kind of found his way to a little bit of humor. He said back to the doctor, I kind of wish that had happened to me last summer before he bombed out of the presidential race. But, you know, there is an interesting subtext to that experience, which is that they told him that if he had still been running for president at that point, he would probably not have survived. The stresses would have been more catastrophic. And so as another doctor said to him, you're a lucky man. And I think, you know, for somebody who would just experience that kind of trauma, took him a moment to grasp that it was, in a sense, a kind of luck. And that is, there's a larger lesson there about his life. I mean, as one of his close advisors, Ted Kaufman, said to me, if you ask me who the luckiest person I know is, I would tell you Joe Biden. And if you ask me who the unluckiest person I know is, I would say it's Joe Biden.
He'll be 78 the day he takes office. I want to be careful to avoid just assuming that old age is a problem, that it diminishes capacities, but almost everybody who is 78 will tell you it feels different than, say, 48. Does Biden himself worry at all about taking on this job at this time in his life?
Well, he thinks about it. He talks about it. I mean, I've spoken to him about age and fitness and when it's the right time to retire. And you know, he thinks a lot about it. I mean, he remembers that his father in you know, President-elect Biden has talked to me about the fact that he encouraged his father to retire earlier than he thinks he should have. He realized in retrospect that it probably was a mistake, that he could have kept working well and productively, and it would have been good for the family and good for him. So he kind of thinks of it in those terms, but he's also quite clear. He says, look, take a look at me. Take a look and decide for yourselves whether you think I am up to the job or not. And I take this rather seriously. I mean, I think if we've learned anything this year, it's that we should probably listen to the words of doctors, not political people, when it comes to health. And on this matter, the doctors are pretty clear. They say that Joe Biden is, as they put it, according to his most recent physical, a healthy, vigorous man of his age. So, you know, he is a man of his age. He's 78. One thing we decided to do as part of my project was that we actually included some of the interviews in the audiobook edition of my book, because I thought it'd be interesting for people to actually hear what does he sound like when he's having a really intensive, sustained interview, not the kind of, you know, 10-second sound bites that you get on a debate stage, but something really serious. And I came away frankly, quite convinced that he has every bit of the fitness that we would expect from somebody at a moment in this incredible challenging job. He's up to the task, no question.
Presumably, the most logical time for him to run for a third and final time would be in 2016. What made him decide not to seek the presidency then?
A couple of important factors. One, he had just lost his son, Beau. We remember it was 2015 when Beau Biden died of a brain tumor. And that was a real punch in the gut. You know, it kind of staggered Joe Biden, even for somebody who'd been through a lot. They were very, very close. And Biden used to say about Beau that he had all of his, he said, he has all my best qualities and none of my worst. And so part of it was that. And then there was another piece of it, which was that his friend and partner, Barack Obama, really wasn't convinced that Biden should run in 2015, 2016. I mean, they had these in conversations in private, the two of them over lunch, where President Obama said to him, look, I'm worried that if this doesn't go well, it might be an embarrassing end to a long and dignified career in public service. He also worried that it might split the party because Hillary Clinton was already emerging as a strong contender. And he was afraid that a weakened, divided Democratic Party might not be up to the task of challenging Donald Trump. And then there's a third piece of it, which I think is important, which is that really the truth is President Obama saw Hillary Clinton as the natural heir to his legacy. I mean, she would be, as he was, a history-making president. She would be the first woman in office. She would also, look, in some ways, she and Obama have a kind of similar, they have a similar intellectual preparation and pedigree. Joe Biden is the first Democratic president not to have gone to an Ivy League school in a very long time. So there are some small but meaningful differences. And Obama encouraged him to think twice about it. In the end, in fact, though, it was one of Biden's closest advisors, Mike Donilon, who has just been named as a senior advisor in the White House. He was the chief strategist in this 2020 campaign. But Mike Donilon took a look at Biden one day, saw a man grieving as seriously as he was, saw it kind of etched on his face, and said to him, I don't think you should do this. And the next day, Biden gave his speech in the Rose Garden with President Obama by his side, and of course, Jill Biden standing by. He said, it's not my year. It's not going to happen. But he said something interesting that year, or that day, which really still stays with me, which is if you go back and look at what he said, he also said, I hope that over the next 4 years, we don't become more divided as a country because I'm afraid for what that'll mean for all of us. And there was a kind of a deep truth to that. He was onto something.
The story about Joe Biden's childhood stutter has been told a lot, and it's, I think, easy to sympathize with his struggle, with his and to admire his ability to overcome it. Did his early speech challenges have anything to do with his tendency, even into the present, to occasionally put his foot in his mouth and say the wrong thing? It doesn't seem to me that those two things would be related.
I think they are related in an interesting way because what you find is that in order to beat the stutter, one of the things that he learned to do was, for one thing, it's easier for him to speak without a text, without reading. He actually is better off the cuff because he's less likely to run into a block. He's less likely to stammer. So that was one of the things. It was part of the reason why he was able to spend 36 years in the Senate without ever learning to use a teleprompter. I mean, he just never did. And then when he came into the administration with President Obama, part of Obama's team, they were a more disciplined outfit, and they said to him, "No, we need you to stay on the prompter." So he started doing it that way. But the other thing was that he had learned these little shortcuts, these little kind of mental tricks of the trade that he could figure out ways of avoiding the things that would trip him up. So one of the things that he learned early on as a teenager was if he started talking before the other person asked him a question, then he could kind of get a little bit of a jump on it and he was less likely to stutter. And he learned that in such a kind of deep way at a formative time in his life that it really set some patterns. I mean, he said as much. He talked to me about it, that he came to believe that he could more or less talk his way through anything. And that was one of the things that got him into politics. He was a pretty good talker. And but it also meant, though, that all of that talking meant that he was occasionally going to, devour a portion of his foot, which seemed to happen now and then.
He did not begin the 2008 presidential run wanting to be anybody's vice president. What kind of deal did he make when he accepted his role at the bottom of the Obama ticket?
He was quite dubious of the idea of being a vice president. I mean, it's worth reminding ourselves he actually said no initially. And then it was his wife, Dr. Jill Biden, who said, "What are you, nuts?" I mean, she said, "Look, you got into this business partly because you care about civil rights. You also believe that this war in Iraq, which you voted for, was a mistake. And here you're being given a chance to help the first black president succeed and perhaps, bring an end to this war in Iraq. How could you say no?" And he said to her, I don't know if I could ever be a number two. How could I have a boss? I haven't had a boss in, ever." And she said, "Grow up." I mean, there's a kind of anybody who has a spouse, I think, will recognize some of that dynamic. But the truth was, they also came up with an important understanding, President Obama and Vice President Biden did, which is Biden said to him that the only way this is going to work is if I have real, if I have your ear, if I really, if I have the, as he put it, "I want to be the last one in the room. I always want to know that I can share my counsel with you, and that it'll be taken seriously." And Obama really valued that. I mean, there were ways in which Obama recognized that Biden had things that Obama did not. I mean, he understood Congress in a way that Biden, in a way that Obama never could. He had abundant experience in foreign affairs, so they came to really rely on each other. But I did gear, I got some an insight into that relationship. Somebody in the White House told me that Obama said to him, "Joe, I always want your counsel. I always want you to be the last one in the room. But I need it in 10-minute increments, not 50-minute increments."
After completing his second term as vice president, Biden entered what might be described as a kind of semi-retirement. What has changed since then? What about Donald Trump's presidency specifically made President-elect Biden decide it was worth throwing his hat in the ring one more time?
I think that there was I mean, to state the obvious, Biden would have been perfectly happy to spend the rest of his time in semi-retirement. I mean, he was working on coordinating cancer research, which is something of immense importance to him because of the death of his son from a brain tumor. And then there was that day, that kind of fateful day in Charlottesville, Virginia, when we all saw the men with torches, white nationalists, walking down the streets of Charlottesville, spewing anti-Semitic racist slogans. And from Biden's perspective, he said that I realized at that point that this was a kind of moral emergency. I mean, those are my words, not his, but that's what this country was facing, that he was really worried. He'd had a sense that Donald Trump was, in his view, not up to the job. But that's very different from believing that Trump might be ushering the country into a disaster. And that's what he came to believe, and he thought it was his role to try to intervene.
My guest is Evan Osnos. He is a winner of the National Book Award and a staff writer at The New Yorker. His new book is called Joe Biden: The Life, the Run, and What Matters Now. You're You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is New Yorker staff writer Evan Osnos, whose new book is called Joe Biden, The Life, The Run, and What Matters Now. Evan, you note that President-elect Biden was careful to avoid being characterized as a liberal when he first arrived in the Senate. Was that a political calculation of some kind or a reflection of the fact that he was not, in fact, all that liberal?
I think there were, it was a bit of both. I mean, at the time, remember, he was representing a district in Delaware that was really completely stranded between North and South. I mean, it was a very much a bipartisan area. You know, it was closer to New York City than Raleigh, North Carolina, but it still had Jim Crow laws in place. And so he was constantly being pulled between these two different big chunks of his constituency. And he had to, in a sense, reflect both of them. He, personally, his politics were pretty progressive for the time. I mean, he had been opposed to the war in Vietnam. He was in favor of civil rights. He received an award in those early years from a progressive organization, gave him a high grade. And he actually did the unusual thing of complaining about it. He said, this makes it harder for me in my district because people think that I'm more liberal than I am. And, you know, he sort of joked, my wife thinks I'm one of the most conservative people she's ever met. I mean, talking about his wardrobe. But the truth was, he really was trying to be a little bit of everything to everyone. I mean, there was a really important moment early on in his term, his first term, when he went to a meeting with voters, with constituents. And he had been at that point a defender of court-ordered busing, and he got criticized for it by his constituents. You know, they said it was mostly white suburbanites, and they didn't like him doing it. And he changed his position, and he became, in a sense, their voice in Congress as an opponent to court-ordered busing. And that was him trying to bridge these multiple complex pieces of the people he represented.
Courting the endorsement of Bernie Sanders in the 2020 primary, he promised to be the most progressive Democratic president since FDR. What does a phrase like that mean to a guy like Joe Biden?
I think it's important to see him in a couple of key ways. One is people change. That's important. I mean, he's been in politics for a very long time. And I think the policies that he advocated in 1973 are not the policies that he advocated in 1993 or 2003, much less 2020. I think that's, and if we're being honest, we kind of want our politicians to be able to change with the country. At one point, there's a great civil rights activist named Cornell William Brooks who talked to me about Biden. And he said, I think anybody who criticizes Biden, and there are reasons to criticize him, it also has to criticize the Democratic Party, because after all, the Democratic Party has changed over that period as well. So I think what you see in Biden making those kinds of what would seem to us to be much more ambitious claims now about wanting to be the most transformative president since the New Deal. I asked President Obama about this as I was working on the book. This summer, I spoke to Obama about what should we think about Biden? And he said, look, I don't think that Joe has changed, but I think the circumstances have changed, meaning within the last few months. He obviously thinks Joe Biden has changed since that, early 1970s. But Biden got into the race saying, I don't think Americans want a revolution. That was his way of kind of staking out some distance with Bernie Sanders. And I think Biden still believes that to this day. But he also believes that the gravity of the events of 2020, the importance of the urgency of addressing the COVID epidemic, the scale of the economic disaster, has called him to be more ambitious than he thought he should be, and he thought Americans would want him to be. So in a way, these two pieces are both elements of Joe Biden's political self-narrative, and they may not be quite as much in contradiction as we might think at the outset.
Just today, we hear a number of names have been added to his list for senior staff members who will serve him in the Oval Office. I'm curious about his management and leadership style in relating to the people who will serve him when he's chief executive. What kind of boss is President-elect Biden?
He has a tendency to want to gather a huge amount of information before he speaks about it. It's kind of a holdover from the very first moments he was in the Senate when he was sort of embarrassed for discovering that he was kind of honking off talking about things he didn't know all that much about. There was one day in which he started talking about oil wells, and somebody in the Senate who actually knew a lot about it said, "Senator Biden, do you know anything about oil wells?" And since then he kind of became known for being this kind of a somewhat of a fanatical preparer. He would ask for briefings, and he was constantly contacting people and trying to get information. I mean, there's a great, interesting letter that somebody dug up from the 70s when he wrote a letter to Hannah Arendt, the great political philosopher, about this kind of obscure lecture she'd given. And he said, "Can you send me a copy of the lecture? Because I'd really like to read about it." Needless to say, I'm talking to you from Washington. There aren't all that many senators who are writing to political philosophers today asking for lectures. I think what you also hear, though, about Biden is, he is a little bit of a chaotic manager. He's not somebody who is running every meeting with forensic discipline about timing. And he has been, he was a senator for his entire professional life before entering the vice presidency. So he has always been part of a kind of a forum rather than an executive. And I mean, the largest staff he's ever run is more or less about 50 people. So I think that one of the challenges for him is going to be all of a sudden you're now the CEO of CEOs. I mean, you run this massive enterprise in the federal government, and it's going to take some real staff support to keep things moving. It's worth pointing out, his first appointment, Ron Klain, chief of staff, is kind of like the he is the classic example of somebody you would want in a position like that, because Biden doesn't come to this with a lot of management experience. Ron Klain does. That's what he does. He was chief of staff to him in the vice presidency, and he's known as a kind of, gloriously unglamorous technocrat, would be how I would put it. And Klain probably wouldn't disagree with that.
All right, let's go to the phones. We have Jackie on the line in Schulenburg, Texas. Hi, Jackie.
I had a question for your interviewer today. Has Joe Biden considered putting on his staff any members from Texas, specifically Beto O'Rourke or Leon Castro?
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, it's a great question. We'll have to find out. I wouldn't be shocked, to be honest. I mean, I think he obviously did forge a relationship with Beto O'Rourke during the campaign. And one of the things that you hear from Biden is the belief that he is, as he says, a transition president. He wants to be the kind of person who brings in a new generation of Democratic leaders. And sometimes he means a more diverse lineup, but he also means diversity in age and experience and location. So I wouldn't be all that surprised if we saw somebody from Texas, but off the top of my head, I don't have names to be able to give you today that would be ironclad. We're not quite there in the process yet. But I think if you keep your eyes peeled over the next few days, you may start to see more detail.
Biden, of course, promised to choose a woman as his running mate, and his selection of Kamala Harris could be characterized as a shrewd political move for a candidate who needed to appeal to women and also people of color. But he had a number of qualified women on his short list. What specifically was it about Kamala Harris that made him choose her?
Well, they had, remember, a pretty tense beginning of their relationship.
Right.
I mean, it started on the debate stage where they had that kind of pretty sharp exchange. And I think for a lot of people, we looked at that from afar, and some people said, well, that's the end of that. There's never going to be a Biden-Harris ticket. But actually, I was never persuaded of that, because if you actually talk to Biden about how he thinks about politics, he's very much of the view that you can have a fierce argument on a Monday, and then you can get up on Tuesday and actually begin to cooperate on something. He really believes it's a kind of senatorial mindset. And he saw in Kamala Harris a combination of qualities that were really important from his perspective, that she could do the job on day one. She had experience in important jobs. She was tested and sort of tempered by that. She also really does represent a whole range of voices that have not been in the White House before. Obviously, the first woman, the first African American, the first Indian American. And that's really important to him, both in terms of getting advice inside the policymaking process, but also in terms of then meaning that he wants those viewpoints in the room. Because, not to reveal a secret here, but Joe Biden is an old white guy, and he knows it. And he's afraid that if he's not aware of what people are really going through and how they're living their lives, that it'll leave him not up to the task. So he's pretty genuine about wanting to understand what people are living through. And then also there's an outward facing part of that too, which is he I think believes that she will be the kind of voice for the administration that will convey that they're trying in a serious way to represent all Americans, not just ones who look like Joe Biden.
What do you know about the kind of vice president they have decided Harris should be? Is there a deal for Harris to be the last one to leave the room?
Well, there is definitely that deal. That's important. They did come to that agreement. It's a slightly different job because, he is not expecting Kamala Harris to be envoy on foreign affairs. He kind of has more of that experience than she does. He's also got a lot of experience on Capitol Hill, so he won't be counting on her that much for that. Her role, I think, is really to be that link to the future, to be the person who helps him stay current and understanding what's going on in the country. That's essential. But being the last voice in the room is a big part of how he sees the vice presidency. You can't underestimate how important it is that he had the job, because he said to me, look, the vice presidency, as I discovered in office, is only what the president makes of it. And so if the president doesn't treat it as a real thing, it just becomes, ribbon cuttings and ceremonial office. And he says that's not a job worth having. So he's pretty emphatic about his belief that this only works if it's a real partnership.
We've heard on occasion that Biden has a temper. What does that look like, and what kinds of things cause him to lose it?
He is very alert to the possibility that if he's going to be saying something publicly, he doesn't like the idea that he will have said the wrong thing, or that he will look like he doesn't know what he's talking about, or if he gets on the line with a foreign leader, that he ends up being unprepared. So, for instance, I've spoken to somebody who, one of his aides, who told me that they were getting ready for a call with a foreign head of state, and Biden had been told to expect that the foreign head of state would say yes to what Biden was asking for. And in fact, it didn't go that way. It went totally pear-shaped, and nothing good came out of the call. And Biden hung up the phone and he said, "Never do that to me again. Never leave me unprepared. If you got to give me bad news beforehand, give it to me, but just don't leave me." There's a touch of insecurity about that, to kind of, in that situation, you hear him kind of blaming the failure of being failure of preparation, when in fact, he wears the jacket for it. But I think what I will say is that I've talked to a lot of people who work for him, and what you discover is that he's a kind of, he's a very intensive person, meaning he's the guy who will pick up the phone and call his staff assistant's mother on her birthday just because he knows it'll give her a thrill. He's kind of like very involved in people's lives. He has this tendency to take people, junior staff members who don't really have much in the way of a kind of, powerful sponsor or background or anything, and he'll thrust them into positions of real responsibility because he sees talent there. So, he also believes really pretty emphatically in kind of the need to rally around people when they're in vulnerable positions. Pete Buttigieg told me a story about how when he first met Biden backstage at a debate, actually they were in Iowa and they were both waiting to go on the stage during the Iowa primary, and Biden comes over to him, and Buttigieg thought, well, he's probably going to talk to me about some political thing. And actually, what Biden said was, "Hey, do you see that staffer of yours over there? That person, used to work with me, and she suffered a terrible tragedy in her life. And just so you know, that's what happened, and she might need some extra support." It was kind of a story that I didn't expect to hear that, and Buttigieg, I think, was quite struck by that.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. How can we expect the president-elect to try and reshape relationships with foreign leaders?
He's a big believer that you basically need to go into the room with a foreign leader and project one idea fundamentally. And as he put it to me, that idea is that he says, "I can't go in there and treat them like an idiot." He says, I think very often what we sometimes do, because we're this big, powerful country, is we go in and we try to tell people across the table what their interests are, or we more or less treat them like they don't understand the situation that they're contending with. He said, that's not a way to prevail in a negotiation. It's not the way to reach any kind of common ground. You have to go in there and treat them fundamentally like, I mean, that's his word. He said, treat them like they're not an idiot. And he believed, I mean, that's actually kind of an extension of his idea of domestic politics too. He says, you know, no matter how much you disagree with somebody, you've got to start from the position that they are, that you at least afford them the respect of believing that they're entitled to their view, and then you can begin to disagree. But if you start with no basis of trust whatsoever, if you're insulting, if you disparage their place or their people, then you're just never going to get anywhere. So that's his kind of core belief. I should add, though, he has this also this other side of him, which is that he tends to be quite confrontational sometimes with foreign leaders who he thinks are not being straight or sort of worthy of that they're not honest, not being honest with him. I mean, at one point during the 70s, actually, he was on a trip to the Soviet Union, and he was listening to a Soviet leader give this kind of long, dishonest monologue. And he got to the end of it, and he said to the person, he said, I'm going to clean this up for radio, but he said, you can't BS a BSer. And the Senator Bill Bradley told me the story, and he said, afterwards, I asked the interpreter who was on the scene, how did you interpret that? How did you translate that into Russian? And the interpreter said, not literally.
My guest is New Yorker staff writer Evan Osnos. He is a winner of the National Book Award, and he has a new book out called Joe Biden, The Life, The Run, and What Matters Now.
We all agreed that we want to get the economy back on track. We need our workers to be back on the job by getting the virus under control. We're going into a very dark winter. Things are going to get much tougher before they get easier. And that requires sparing no effort to fight COVID so that we can open our businesses safely, resume our lives, and put this pandemic behind us. It's going to be difficult, but it can be done.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That was President-elect Joe Biden talking about the need to get COVID-19 under control. My guest this hour is New Yorker staff writer Evan Osnos, whose new book is called Joe Biden, The Life, The Run, and What Matters Now. Evan, the president-elect said yesterday more people may die from COVID if the Trump administration continues to delay a sort of complete and typical transition period. What do you know about whether, at least on the health front and the COVID front, there is some kind of transition happening under the table?
No, there really isn't, I'm afraid. I mean, it's really no joke. I mean, it's really kind of, this is a very stark break from the patterns that we've seen in American history. If you think about the way that the George W. Bush transition handed off to the Obama administration with incredible levels of coordination. I mean, it was President Bush took real pride in doing that. And I mean, if you listen to the statements that Condoleezza Rice made at the time about how she looked forward to being personally helpful in any way she could to the incoming Secretary of State, it's just a world apart from where we are. But no, I've been in touch with the Biden transition constantly these days, and they are getting no help from the Trump presidents, from the Trump administration. And I think it's worth, making that quite clear. I mean, history should record that this president, according to reports of the last few days, has not participated in a coronavirus briefing in 5 months. And he is being described in reports from the White House as the word I saw in the Washington Post was that he has discontinued most of his official duties. So he is at the moment not really attending to the coronavirus epidemic.
President Trump will have to leave the White House on Inauguration Day, right? But it seems unlikely that he will observe anything like the norms of past presidents remaining under the radar, refraining from openly criticizing their successors. The thing I keep wondering, Evan, is whether mainstream media, which is to say nonpartisan media, will decide to give those remarks a platform anyway. Do you have any sense of that?
You mean whether they'll give President-elect Biden's remarks, the platform, or
whether
Trump
is former president, will he continue to take up headlines in major newspapers and on the evening news?
I can speak for myself, which is that I think that it's pretty clear that we're approaching a point when it's time to decenter Donald Trump from our public lives. I mean, he's lost the presidency. The voters have spoken. And there comes a point at which we're making a choice about whether to allow him to take up this much space in our brains. And there is we are making choices as institutions, as journalism institutions, about whether or not to give him a platform. And I actually predict that he may begin to slip away a little bit faster than we sometimes assume. Obviously, there is going to be a kind of there are parts of the media that really do build their business around amplifying what he says. And that's going to be the same afterwards. But, history moves on. There are going to be ambitious Republicans, young Republicans coming up who want to jockey for some of that space at the top of the party. And they're going to be looking for ways of taking some of that attention. So it might not be. And, Donald Trump is staring down the runway at least two serious investigations by separate jurisdictions looking into his record in office and his business life. So he's going to have a pretty full plate. I think you may find that it may not be that Donald Trump's tweets have quite the same effect when he's a private citizen than they do when he's the most powerful person in the world.
As Obama's vice president, Joe Biden, you remind us here, was likely to reinforce the president's penchant for restraint in foreign affairs, which put him in stark contrast with a vice president like Dick Cheney. What can we expect from a Biden doctrine once Joe Biden is the guy who has the final say on foreign affairs and military intervention?
I think you've seen that over the course of his career, he's had a few moments that have really impacted his decision making around the use of American force abroad. He took pride in the 90s in having supported the bombing campaign in the Balkans that was designed to protect civilians in Bosnia. He really believes that was like a smart use of force. And then, as we remember, he voted for the war in Iraq in 2003, and that was a disaster. And he looks upon it as the biggest mistake he made in his Senate career. And it was a real catastrophe. And in the years after that, you see him take a much more restrained view of the use of American force. He argued against the U.S. intervention in Libya. He was wary, in fact, of the raid to kill Osama bin Laden. Not that he didn't think we should do it, but he thought that the intelligence was not as squared away as he wanted it to be. He was afraid that if it failed, that it would drag down Obama's presidency, sort of the way that Jimmy Carter was damaged by the failed effort to rescue hostages in Iran. So there was some of that. I think he has taken very deeply the view that when the president sends troops abroad, that this is an impact not only on the countries where they're going and on the troops themselves, but it has just ripple effects across all of American society. And he says this with some personal interest. After all, his son Beau was deployed. He was in the military. The family considers itself very much a military family for that reason. And he takes those issues deeply seriously.
He has said he will reinstate the U.S. commitment to the Paris Climate Agreement, if not on his first day in office, very soon thereafter. What other executive orders is Biden lining up for his earliest days in office?
I think the Paris Climate Agreement is a big one, partly because it's not just a gesture of his belief in the urgency of the science, but also that he believes this is a measure of the United States' return to the world as a kind of willing partner rather than the era of America First. And so I think you're likely to see them put a big emphasis on that. Also rejoining the World Health Organization. We're at a moment right now when we're aware of the ways in which countries are impacting one another in health terms. So I think you're likely to see him move fast on that too. And those early efforts sometimes are symbolic more than anything else. But in those cases, those are actually meaningful policy. They have real policy impact too.
He spent decades in the Senate as compared with, you know, President Obama's single sort of truncated term. Obama was sometimes criticized for not forging particularly strong relationships with lawmakers. As you noted, Biden doesn't even need Harris to take this on for him. How do you imagine he will relate to members of Congress when he occupies the Oval Office?
He kind of, he really likes those relationships. He thinks that they are, if used well, that they can advance the business of government. I mean, he really, this is one way in which he and President Obama really were different. I mean, the truth is that Obama, at the end of a busy day, if he's sort of been out glad handing and giving speeches and stuff, he's very depleted and he wants to, you know, read and be alone and kind of restore. And Biden's not that way. I mean, Biden kind of draws energy from it. Somebody who worked very closely with him for a long time was telling me about how they were on the campaign trail together not too long ago, and they'd get to the end of the day and Biden would, you know, will have given a dozen speeches and he'd get back to his hotel room and he's so kind of wired up, he couldn't go to sleep and he would watch two movies before he could go to sleep. Meanwhile, this guy was like flat on his back. So yeah, there's something, you know, that's partly how Biden just is as a person and then partly what he thinks is the basis of successful politics. There was a funny moment back in the Obama years when Obama was giving a speech at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and he said, you know, people tell me I need to go out and have a drink with Mitch McConnell. That would solve everything. Well, you know what? You go have a drink with Mitch McConnell and tell me what it's like. And I think there was a little bit of truth to that. And the truth is, you know, even though Biden doesn't drink, he and Mitch McConnell actually have a relationship as people. I mean, Mitch McConnell was the only Republican senator that attended Beau Biden's funeral in 2015. And nobody pretends that that means that, you know, Mitch McConnell is going to wake up on the first day of the Biden presidency and suddenly say he wants to make every deal. But you have to believe there is some value in them having a basis for trust. They've made deals before. They negotiated the deal in 2012 to avert the fiscal cliff catastrophe, which was generated by Republicans in Congress. And it made some Democrats angry. They thought he could have driven a harder bargain, but he did make a deal. So I wouldn't count out the possibility that they'll be able to work together in some respects.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Why doesn't Joe Biden drink?
He's very aware that in his family, in his DNA, in his genes, that he has this very strong propensity towards addiction. I mean, he shared a bedroom as a child with one of his uncles, his mother Jean's brother, known as Uncle Boo Boo. And as he said, Uncle Boo Boo drank too much. We all knew it, even as kids. And he's really conscious of that. And there's been a lot of alcoholism in the family. His son Hunter obviously has been public about having some very serious addiction problems, alcohol and drugs. And Biden decided early on, really as a teenager, that he sort of said, I have this demon within me and I can't control it. And I'm just never going to allow it to take over my life.
Will Jill Biden continue to work outside her responsibilities as First Lady as she did when she was Second Lady?
It's an interesting question, and I haven't heard an answer to that. It might be harder for her to do it as First Lady. It really was history making when she did it as Second Lady. I mean, it was only, I think Abigail Adams was the last Second Lady to have worked outside the White House. So it had been a while. And Joe Biden has, of course, continued teaching at a community college near Washington right up until very recently, I think, if not until today. So I don't know if she'll be able to do it as First Lady. It's actually a pretty busy job, so we'll just have to see. I don't have an answer to that one.
Does President-elect Biden have a strategy in mind for dealing with a not insignificant fraction of Americans who see him as somehow illegitimately elected, regardless of how specious the evidence for that has been?
His basic view is that you can begin to wear down even the most adamant animosity if you start from the principle that the only way to even begin that process is by showing somebody that you're listening to them, that you give them the basic respect of acknowledging that they have a right to an opinion that's different than yours. And that's pretty baked into who he is. Now, look, you know, if you heard him give his victory speech the other night, you know, he didn't spike the football in the end zone. What he said was, we are not enemies. And it's the kind of language that's sort of a political cliche. We don't even hear it, really, except that it's a really powerful idea. I mean, it goes back to Abraham Lincoln's first inaugural address in 1860. He said the same thing. And, you know, these days, to say something like that is practically a radical thing to say. But he really believes it. He just finds it kind of unconvincing that Americans are intractably divided. He believes that if we can find some ways to collaborate, that that's the first step to making something happen. I think you're likely to see him try to forge some level of compromise around a stimulus plan to deal with the COVID epidemic. You know, something like that, which is so sort of glaringly necessary and urgent, that that can become a basis for maybe something more. But, you know, he has no illusions. This is a country that is now divided for larger reasons than just Donald Trump. It gets to the whole nature of our media, the nature of where we live and how we live, and, you know, what we read online and the technology that's in our hands every day. So it's going to take more than one president to be able to solve the problem. But his deep belief is that the words of a president really matter, and that the words of that president, as we've seen over the last 4 years, can drive us further apart, or they can begin to chip away at some of those divisions.
Does presidential temperament still influence sort of national temperament? I mean, we've gone from a president who was quite bombastic on a regular basis to one who is seen, even by those who worked really hard to keep him from being president, as sort of avuncular and likable.
I think it turns out that it probably does matter, but we won't know for a little while. I think somebody who works with Biden and worked with him in the White House said, I think we're just ready to have a boring president again for a while. And in some ways, there's a deep truth to that, which is that we kind of want to push politics back into its proper place in our minds, which is that it doesn't need to be the all-consuming fact of our lives. You know, does it really need to be the thing that governs absolutely every encounter we have at the Thanksgiving table? Or should it be this thing that sort of hums in the background and hopefully, if you're using it right, can actually make your lives a little safer and a little healthier? That's his view. So in a way, you know, Biden just is of the view that you don't have to treat politics as blood sport. You can treat it as this forum for fashioning some way to be together as a people. And it doesn't need to be any more fierce than that. One of the things that I think he carries with him very distinctly is the imprint of having lost some races in his life. And he says, you know, I've lost a lot more than a presidential race. And I know what it means to really lose and really win.
The new book by New Yorker staff writer Evan Osnos is Joe Biden, The Life, The Run, and What Matters Now. Evan, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
My pleasure. I enjoyed the conversation.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. Just type KERA Think into the search bar wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to ours, or check out our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.